My interest in the history of the family began with the discovery of the judgment of Lord Armadale in the case of a contested estate belonging to a cousin of my father's, William Murray. William Murray was born at Dalcouharn in Dumbartonshire in 1841 and died in a London hotel in 1915. In 1852, his father, a factory worker, was killed in a works accident. His mother, whether alive or dead then, I do not know, apparently did not long survive. He had one brother who was lost at sea and for whom he advertised from time to time in the newspapers regarding news of his fate. He had no sisters. At the age of 11, for I know nothing of his life before then, he went to live with an aunt near Glasgow, but his life there was not very happy, and after a year or so he transferred his residence to that of an uncle who was called Donald Murray, an agent of a branch of the Commercial Bank of Scotland and working in Rutherglen. There is no doubt that in the ensuing years his uncle taught him all the elements of banking. As a young man, he went to China and worked there, and in India until about 1874, when he retired at the age of 33 years, apparently pretty wealthy. From that time onwards, he appears to have travelled pretty well all over the world. New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the United States, Mexico, many European countries, Algeria, Morocco, and other places. He appears to have suffered from a mild bronchial asthma and to have determined that life in Scotland, at any rate the climate there, was not very suitable for his trouble. In Scotland, the law permits the succession to an estate only to paternal cousins. Maternal cousins do not share in the division of the estate, and this was the reason for the legal battle which occurred between 1915 and 1918. My father, George Mackay, represented the Mackay element, and Colonel Robert Simpson Murray, a solicitor, represented the Murray element. The great question for Lord Armadale to decide was whether Murray had abandoned a domicile in Scotland in favour of that in London, or whether he had retained it. He summarised the evidence pretty much as follows. He admitted that Murray lived in London during his 40 years of retirement, but never owned any property there. He lived either in as a lodger or in a hotel. His main headquarters appear to have been with Mrs. Mitchell over a fair number of years, and there is considerable correspondence between them on mundane matters. Every year, when not abroad, he appears to have gone up to Scotland, sometimes for the shooting. He presented two collections of valuable books to Stranraer School Board. When abroad, a friend of his always sent to him a copy of the Glasgow Herald. One of his cherished but few possessions was a kilt, and I've no doubt it was of the Murray tartan. He does not appear to have had any important business interests. His main hobby was looking into second-hand bookshops, of which he obtained a fairly valuable collection, and the other was looking in at shop windows, a feature which still characterizes some members of the family. His habits were apparently simple, and he greatly preferred Scotch dishes to English. Presumably, therefore, he included the haggis as one as of his favourite dishes. He belonged to the Grosvenor Club and also to the Oriental Club. During most of his life, he was in correspondence with his best friend and first cousin, namely George Simpson Murray, who acted for him upon occasion. As a youth, it is fairly certain that he spent some part of his summer holidays in the home of his grandparents, namely John Murray II and Anne Matheson, because some years after their death, he erected a beautiful memorial stone in the highest part of the cemetery at Rogart. It is probable that on these holiday occasions he came in contact with my father's family, at any rate with those who were still young enough to live at Bonar Bridge. In the opinion of Lord Armadale, the evidence to suggest that he had become an Englishman, losing his Scotch nationality, appears to have been considered very weak, and the judge found quite definitely that he had never abandoned his claim to Scottish nationality. The estate amounted to some £43,000 in all, and my father's share was about £1,300. The reason for the smallness of his share was this, that although there were originally 55 first cousins of the deceased, only 33 had survived his death, and the total sum was divided amongst those 33, giving doubtless much pleasure and in some cases very great help to the recipients. From 1915 to 1918, while the case was sub judice, I was in the army, but my father gave me odd details about how it was going on. As a reward, anyway, I did receive a present of 10 volumes of Chambers Encyclopedia, split new, wonderful present. I chose this in preference to a bicycle, in deference to the wishes of my father, who considered bicycles were dangerous implements.
Of the 33 cousins who participated in the Will of China Bill, perhaps the most interesting families are the Murrays, the descendants of the provost of Rutherglen, who was the eldest son of Anne Matheson and John Murray, the second. And the youngest of that family was Janet Murray, who married William Mackay, who was the grandfather and grandmother of R.L.M. Now, those four Murray brothers who participated in the will were John Murray, who became a banker in New Zealand, and more of him anon, and his brother Robert Stephen Murray, born in 1840, died in 1922. He was the first colonel. He followed his father as bank agent and was a solicitor, borough chamberlain, and colonel in the volunteers, and was a great friend of his cousin William Murray China Bill. And the third brother was George William Murray, who became a farmer in New Zealand and then a school teacher. And the youngest of the family, James Ewer Murray, born in 47, died in 1929. He was a teacher first, and then he became a farmer in New Zealand. These two, brought up on the Bible and porridge in New Zealand, one gave up the porridge and the other gave up the Bible. In the early months of 1863, Donald and Isabel Murray went down to the quay at the Broomalaw, Glasgow, to watch the departure for New Zealand of the SS Allo. The sailing list showed the following four names: John Murray and his wife Frances, George William and James Ewer Murray, three of his sons and his new daughter-in-law, all in one brief hour. I wonder if they also went down to the Broomalaw in July 64 to wave goodbye to China Bill as he set off for Shanghai. And in 1866, when their banker nephew, Donald Murray Mackay, left for New Zealand on the SS William Davis. The elder, John Murray, who became a banker in New Zealand, in 1863, at the age of 27, he joined the Bank of New Zealand at Auckland. 64, he became manager of the Bank of Otago at Invercargill in the South Island. In 1866, he rejoined the Bank of New Zealand as an inspector, then played an important part in the development of the bank. A general manager in 88, later became a director, but retired when the directory was removed to London and his association with the bank ceased. In the years 1881 to 1885, he had been warning the bank about its too free lending policy, and in 1883 he was liquidating bad assets for the board. In 88, he had a breakdown in health and had 6 months' leave for medical advice in London. His activities from 88 to 92 are not well noted, nor his movements. Meanwhile, in these years, the financial state of the bank was steadily worsening, and John was in retirement. J.H. Schofield, in the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography, wrote, "When the banking crisis occurred in 1892, the directors consulted Murray, and with their authority he approached the government with a disclosure of the critical position of the bank. Unless assistance was forthcoming, he said, it would have to close its doors. The responsibility of devising a scheme of assistance devolved upon him. Shareholders and directors accepted his advice, and Seddon, the then Prime Minister, adopted the scheme as the basis of the banking measures in June 1894. M. Kennedy says that although Murray was out of the bank at the time, the directors and general manager left the whole task to him. When the bank was re-established, Murray retired in bad health and spent the rest of his life in New South Wales. He paid several visits to Great Britain and lived eventually at Bathurst, New South Wales, where he died on the 30th of June 1915. Murray had considerable literary gifts and contributed occasionally to the press. He was a sincere philanthropist and associated himself with social movements in Auckland. John Murray's son, Donald Murray, called by us the inventor, he was born in 1865 and died in 1945. Donald writes of himself, "I had gone through New Zealand and afterwards Sydney universities, and for my degree I took logic, mental, moral and political philosophy. I spent 12 years and some thousands of pounds in developing the Murray Automatic, my high-speed typewriter, which worked nearly 200 words per minute." That was in 1899. "I took the outfit to New York in March and had a room at the old Astor Hotel in Lower Broadway and had the time of my life in showing the invention to all sorts of people. Philip T. Lodge, president of the Linotype Company, came to see it. Also representatives of telegraph companies. In Press the Button Telegraphy, he wrote, "Notice, attention is specially invited to the letter at the end of this pamphlet. I ask for the sympathy of all fair-minded men against the unscrupulous tactics of a big American company which is trying to deprive me of the legitimate fruits of my labor." This refers to an offer by the Western Electric Company, which Donald considered inadequate. "The answer then made to me by the company was that they could get round my patents. Between 1902 and 1912, Murray visited Calcutta, Bombay, Vienna, Prague, Gothenburg, Bergen, Edinburgh, Dublin and Leeds, giving exhibitions of his apparatus also in London, Paris, Petrograd and Moscow. The Glasgow Herald and the Edinburgh Scotsman were very early users of his machine. This machine is now in the GPO Museum in London." Murray had a brilliant and exciting period as an inventor, but details of his progressive inventions are too technical for us. I intend passing them on to my son Alan, who will make them available for any reader in the family. Instead, I now quote from the Journal of the Institution of Electrical Engineers, 1945, by a man with the initials HHS, who wrote Donald's obituary notice. "Donald Murray, M.A., died on the 14th of July, 1945. He took up journalism, for he had a facile pen. He was also a born mechanic, so that the features of the new paper office attracted him, and ideas of setting type by telegraph began to germinate in his mind. New York in 1898, GPO London 1900. Paper on setting type by telegraph awarded the FEI Premium Prize in 1905. He designed a system of multiple telegraphy which had important advantages over that of Baudin, adopted by French telegraph administration. Other prizes followed. Later he sold his American rights in his multiplex system, but retained its manufacture and sale in Europe in his own hands until his retirement. As an employer, he was stern but just, and he gathered round him a group of craftsmen who were unrivaled. Two of his books, The Philosophy of Power and The Theory of Control, have been published. A third book is unfinished. He was halfway through this. And in 1940, when brain trouble set in, he underwent three operations in Monte Carlo, after which he and Mrs. Murray moved into Switzerland. But he was too ill to take up his work again and lingered on in a state of invalidism, never fully recovering. He became a member of the Institute in 1910. In the field of machine telegraphy, his name deserves to rank with those of Wheatstone, Kelvin, Baudot, and Goulstad. Donald, in his book, says, "My success as a telegraph engineer was based on theory, general principles, and pathfinding. In that respect, I claim to stand high also in the philosophy of power." Long before the sixth volume is finished, readers will appreciate new ideas. There has been nothing like the flow of new ideas in the philosophy of power before or since Herbert Spencer wrote his wonderful Synthetic Philosophy. In this book, entitled The Philosophy of Power, First Principles, by Donald Murray, published in 1939 by Williams and Norgate, London, when Donald was aged 74, the author gives his own autobiography, too long to quote in full. Our local library in Wolverhampton obtained a copy for me to read from the National Central Library, London. The card inside showed it had been borrowed in 41 and in 48, but not thereafter until now. The signed dedication runs, "I dedicate this book on the philosophy of power to all men of power, moulders of the destiny of mankind by word and deed, religious and secular leaders, philosophers, statesmen, inventive engineering and scientific pioneers, social organizers, builders of industry, and above all to Christ and Lucifer. May those who are still with us long be spared to serve their country and mankind. And when at last the great lady of night comes to guide them, may the winds of Arun Gandhi between the worlds blow gently on their crossing." The so-called biographical notes of Appendix A are obviously provided by Donald himself, for he gives an ancestry stretching back to Moravia in Roman times. Education. Suffered the usual idiocies of better class English education in Auckland, and in 1884 went to the Agricultural College in Canterbury, New Zealand for 2 years. Had a first-class scientific and particularly electrical and mechanical education, combined with 72 years of extremely varied experience all over the world, from Fiji to Moscow and Rio de Janeiro, including 12 years of newspaper work and 25 years of telegraph engineering. Career. Farmer, New Zealand. Journalist, New Zealand and Australia. Printing, telegrapher, engineering and inventor, New York, London, Berlin, Petrograd. Philosopher, Monte Carlo. Several of Murray's printing and telegraph machines are in the South Kensington Museum, London. Journalism. In spite of 2 years at the Agricultural College, farming proved unsuitable. In 1886, went to Europe, round Cape Horn, wintered in Dresden, visited the ancestral home of the Morayes in Moravia, and returned to Auckland, where I joined the New Zealand Herald and graduated BA at the university. Went to the Sydney Morning Herald in 1891 and took MA at that university. Inventor. He had a brilliant and exciting period as an inventor, but the details of his progressive invention are too technical for these notes I've already mentioned. Here follows a very interesting letter from the inventor's father to his favorite niece, Mrs. Ethel Maxwell Robertson of Hastings, New Zealand. It was written from 218 Rocket Street, Bathurst, New South Wales, 6th of June, 1912. My dear Ethel, I duly received yours of the 7th of March. Pleased to note that you have been very busy, which is good for you. Isabel seems to have had a narrow escape, and I'm sorry to learn that your father, James Ewan Murray, that her general health is indifferent. Glad to hear that your mother benefited from her trip and that you are able to speak of her as in fair health. As to my son Donald's marriage, of which you saw an account, he wrote me at the time announcing the event, and I had also a little note from his wife. In a subsequent letter, he tells me he has sold the American rights to his apparatus for £5,000 and is confident of getting as much more from Europe. I lately had a letter from Helen, a niece of John, dated from Dresden, where she had gone, she says, to get some music. She purposed shortly after going on an Italian tour. I note that you have given up the piano for the mandolin, an instrument of which I have no knowledge, so cannot well remark upon it. If it aids in the development of your musical taste, it will suffice. I got your last photo. It is an excellent one, and you look well in it. That you enjoyed Hamlet as well, especially if it leads the way to a higher appreciation of Shakespeare. I hear from Uncle George now and again. That's her farmer uncle, who became a teacher 1840 to 1926. He doesn't seem quite satisfied with his new abode, or rather with the locality of it, and pines for Ponsonby. He was too hasty committing himself. Lately, I had letters from my daughter Frances and her husband. He had taken up a rather important appointment in Beira in Portuguese East Africa, but as that is in the tropics, Francis is in rather a quandary about taking the children thither. Meanwhile, she has settled herself at Rouen and contemplates a rather indefinite stay in France. I am sending you a photo of Rouen, which I had from Helen, little in it except that it is very French. I have been sending you the Melbourne magazine Life also, sent Collier's Weekly, though doubtful if it's worth sending. I fear too that I may have let you in for some pennies of fines for deficient postage through mistake. The last I sent a week or two ago I saw to being right. I note you had a good butter year, and as I observed they had threatenings of drought in England. You may have another if the drought persists and extends to the continent. You do not seem very hopeful of the farm being sold. You had lately been reading a book about pros and cons. Well, this selling question has cons as well as pros. Of course, you women regard only the pros. As well have a glance at the other aspect. If your father could sell at a reasonable price and get a satisfactory installment of cash down, I should say he'd be wise to sell. But if he only got a paltry sum, that would not do. For the buyer, it would be a case of Heads I win, tails you lose. Meanwhile, after all, you are not so badly situated. Might be better, I dare say, but that is a case of very general application in human life. Your mother, it seems, would want to settle at Eltham if the farm were sold. That would be idiotic. The chief reason for selling the farm, in my view, is that you might be in a position to shift to a better climate, better for her health, not to speak of Isabella's. The Eltham Hayward region has, for them at least, one of the worst climates in New Zealand. Even North Plymouth would be better, not to say Napier. Nor would I advise Auckland. If she gets free from the farm, she should travel a bit. That would be like to really benefit for her health. As for myself, I have really nothing to say that could be of any interest to you. I keep well enough for my years. What with my books, car, and friends, I rub along comfortably, waiting for the inevitable nearing breakup. He was age 75 then. I do not go out so much, or at least so far, with my vehicle as I did in summer. The drought we have had has cut up the roads, not as you folks would have it with mud, but with sand or dust, which are abhorrent to the motor car. Fortunately, we have had rain at last and may hope that the drought has broken. We had no rain worth mentioning for 5 months and virtually none at all for 3 months. Over the interior, the poor sheep have been dying by the 100,000, and even this rain will not help them much, at least in the southern part of this state, and in Victoria because winter is on and no growth of herbage. But north in Queensland, where it is warmer, the trouble will be less. All along, they have had heaps of rain in the coast region.